this works. This is what we always do. We talk about the technology first, right? Okay. All right, well, people around Locust Grove know that I'm more than a little obsessed with the musical Hamilton. Lately, they've been trying to hide their eye rolling, and I think there's an intervention being planned. Nonetheless, you may find me from time to time referring to the musical. I understand it's an interpretation of history. It's not history, but I think it gives us some insights into some of the events of the day that are really quite interesting and valuable. So bear with me for a moment. I will get to Aaron Burr. I think Hamilton is very important, and one reason why it fascinates historians as well as the general theater-going public is that it puts the viewer back in a time in the story of America when we didn't know that there would be a story of America. We didn't know the ending. We were British, we were immigrants from around the world, we were Germans, Dutch, and French, we were from the Caribbean, we were Polish, we were even Indian. We were Native American. We were slaves from Guinea and the Ivory Coast and Mozambique. We didn't know what the story of America would be. The musical takes us back to that not knowing time and puts us in the shoes of the people at any point in history who never know what comes next until it comes next. But we know now, to some extent, or we think we do, we're omniscient, and they were not. People in the Revolutionary era made choices without knowing the outcome. They took actions without knowing who was working against them behind the scenes. They made judgments about people, and they took risks without knowing, we might know now, that they're actually dealing with scoundrels. So, do this without so much rustling. Which brings us to Aaron Burr. Aaron Burr, who is a bit of an enigma. Now, you might think, knowing as you do, that he shot and killed Alexander Hamilton, and I'm assuming you know that, right? I'm not spoiling the plot of the musical. Okay. You would think that a musical called Hamilton would cast Burr as the absolute villain, but not quite. He's the narrator of the musical. He introduces the characters in the scenes. He comments on Hamilton's character, and he takes part in the action of the play. In the end, he calls himself the villain in your history. He's reflecting on the intersection of his life and Hamilton's. But one of the overriding themes of the play is that you have no control. Who lives, who dies, and who tells your story. So that's what we're here for. We're going to tell Burr's story for him. I'll be talking, this was billed as the Burr Conspiracy, and we will get there, but I think that knowing more about Burr's life kind of leads to why he did what he did at the time that he did, so there'll be a little background on Burr. So I just want to confess that I am not a Burr scholar. I am not somebody who spent a lot of time in the archives researching Burr, read his letters, and visited his house. I'm really trying to figure him out. Now, when we realized that Burr had a connection to Locust Grove, we realized that he was an important character to know more about, and he is really tricky to figure out. I've been doing a lot of reading. I've read some original documents. I've read a lot of historians, and I'm trying to figure him out. So maybe at the end in a discussion, we can all be part of that. I'm sure we have some big Aaron Burr fans here, and some people who do see him as the villain in our history. So we'll see where we end up. But I want to understand the context of his actions after the famous duel, when he traveled to the West, when he came to Locust Grove. And I'm intrigued by the depths of his character that are probably really unknowable at this point. So let's look again at the part where we don't know quite what's going on. Here's the United States at the time the Revolutionary War ended. And look, you see Great Britain dripping down from above into what the United States is claiming as its territory. You see Spain hovering over there to the west. Spain underneath. There's nothing to say that what we know is going to happen, that the United States will go from sea to sea, is actually what will occur. There's an inevitability that we see that They didn't have. So forget that the United States, we know it's going to, we'll speak English, we'll go from sea to sea. But remember now a world with threats from powerful European countries on all sides. So in 1804, for George Rogers Clark, or for Thomas Jefferson, or for Aaron Burr, none of that was inevitable. Spain was weak, but it still held vast territories. Maybe Spain would hold on to all of it. I was intrigued when I learned that the city of San Francisco was founded in 1776, the same year that we look at the establishment of the United States by Spain. And it's, you know, what seems inevitable to us, and of course that will be America, was in no way known at the time. In the far west, we even had a Russian colony. So to just rewind, which is a reference to Hamilton, I told you I was going to do that. Who was Aaron Burr, anyway? So let's look at a younger Burr. Very few of the vice presidents of the United States have ever shot anyone while in office. There are really only two. And Burr is the only one who actually killed someone. So his name is always associated with a shocking event, with a crime, with a tragedy. He's also been associated with the charge of treason and plotting against the United States based on his actions in the so-called Burr Conspiracy of 1805-6. There was an Aaron Burr before that. Near the end of Hamilton, the musical, Burr tells us, "History obliterates in every picture it paints." And he has been painted very darkly by historians and by the public. But how much of that is really due to the work of his political enemies during his lifetime? And he was a man who had a lot of political enemies. How much of it was due to his own actions? Can we separate his own actions from the accusations of his political enemies, and can we see him more clearly? So, to rewind, let's go back to the beginning. So Burr was born in Newark, New Jersey. It was exactly 263 years ago. And that, by the way, made him either 1 year younger or 1 year older than Alexander Hamilton, who was always a bit cagey about when he was born. And Hamilton's life and career paralleled Burr's to a degree that was somewhat maddening to both of them. Burr's family was very distinguished, even aristocratic, Presbyterian, prominent, educated, and cultured. His father was a president of the College of New Jersey, which we now know as Princeton. His mother was a wit and a free thinker and unusually respected for her learning. She was a daughter of the eminent theologian Jonathan Edwards. But Burr's early years seemed cursed. Before he was two, his father died, followed 7 months later by his maternal grandfather, and a month later his mother died as well. His maternal grandmother stepped in and took in Burr and his sister, and she died 6 months later. So all of his tragedies before he's even 3 years old. Finally, the young Burrs, Burr and his sister, found a permanent home with their uncle, who was a lawyer in a large and close family. So he did eventually achieve a family. He was, this is Princeton, I'm sorry, it's a little fuzzy. He was physically small, and when he was young, he was frail. But he was brilliant, and Burr entered Princeton at the age of 13. Now, to some extent, college then was a bit more like a prep school than we would think of college now, but nonetheless, he was able to take advantage of some funds that had been left by his father to get an education. He was intended for either the church or the law, very aristocratic professions, and he studied philosophy, he studied the Scottish Enlightenment, he read widely, and he joined the political and social clubs at college that turned these young provincials of America into sophisticated aristocrats, and also into, at this time period, revolutionaries. So, by, you know who this is?
Yes.
Who knows? Okay. By 1773, he had faithfully met Alexander Hamilton, who had recently arrived from the Caribbean. And Burr met Hamilton just as Hamilton was being thrown out of Princeton. Hamilton then entered King's College in Manhattan, which is now Columbia University. And both men, who were really, in a way, boys, were thrown into the rebellion, the revolution, and talking about rights, staying up late at night, debating when to take action, when to stop talking, when to take action. And when the fighting started, they both separately joined in with the action. Burr signed on to the 1775 invasion of Canada to bring Canada into the revolution. He was at the side of General Richard Montgomery when he was fatally shot in Quebec. There's a line in Hamilton. Anybody want to say it along with me? When General Montgomery got a bullet in the neck in Quebec. It's a funny way to say it, but it was a devastating loss of an important military leader very early in the fighting. And despite Burr's heroic actions that day, it's said that he helped to recover the general's body. He was frustrated with the lack of recognition, lack of promotion that he felt was his due. So he arrived back in New York in time to serve under General Israel Putnam, and he acted bravely and independently during the rout that was the Battle for Manhattan, the battle where British troops arrived in New York Harbor, attacked Brooklyn, and then entered Manhattan, and George Washington and his army scrambled to the north, to Harlem, to get out of the way. Burr even rescued Hamilton's company from a sure capture as the British landed on the east side of the island and began to surround the Continental troops. Burr was there for the series of brutal battles through his native New Jersey and for, oh, whoops, I'm sorry, I missed General Montgomery getting a bullet in the neck in Quebec. It was a dramatic scene that was painted and it's sort of a touchstone for people about bravery. So here we're in Valley Forge. So Burr was there for the series of brutal battles through his native New Jersey. He was at the Valley Forge Winter, and there he probably encountered another young officer. Who is this young man? William Cron, along with Hamilton, who was there again, and the Marquis de Lafayette. And finally, Burr was promoted to lieutenant colonel, and that was the military rank that he carried through the rest of his career. And in the years after the Revolution, many of the men who had fought did continue to use their military titles, so you sometimes see him referred to lieutenant colonel much later in his life. So all of these men were young leaders. They were creating an army from the raw materials that they were handed, the raw materials they could scrounge. Burr was known as a good and fair administrator, an excellent executive, handling logistics and men effectively. He was not close to George Washington. Hamilton, however, ingratiated himself with the commander-in-chief. Burr met during the war and courted the married Theodosia Bartow Prevost. She was first a friend, and then a lover, and finally a wife. She was married to Jacques Marcus Prevost, a British officer who was posted to Georgia and then to Jamaica, while Theodosia tarried back in New Jersey, entertaining the Continentals and skillfully playing both sides, Patriot and British. When Prevost died, she and Burr were married, and there's more to say about her, which we will talk about a little bit later. But there's a second Burr-Cron connection. Bear with me here. Mark Prevost, he's over there, the Prevosts are in red, was the nephew of Augustin Prevost, who had married Susanna, or was the uncle, rather, of Augustin Prevost, who had married Susanna Cron, who, if you look over here where the Crons are, is William Cron's cousin. Now, this looks really quite elaborate. You know, who are all these people? You've got Theodosia, who's marrying twice to Burr and to Prevost. You have the uncles up above, or the previous generation, Nicholas Cron and George Cron, who are the parents of William and Susanna, respectively. So many of the people involved in this story have these kinds of links of marriage, of social association. So this connection puts them in the same social circles, puts Cron and Burr in a way that they could quite easily be introduced to each other and socialize. We don't know that that happens. I don't know that there's anything in Aaron Burr's papers that refers to William Cron directly, but they have to have known about each other at the very least. And when William Cron, and many of us know William Cron's story, was captured in Charleston later on in the war, it was the Prevost connection that got him paroled. So the Prevost play an important part in Cron's story and in Burr's story. Burr heard stories about exploration west from members of the Prevost family, and of course exploring the west was a theme of the era, but this put him in contact with people who really had been there. Okay, we're going to skip ahead to after the war. We won, so it took a little while, but New York. I love this scene of New York. Again, it's a little bit fuzzy, I'm sorry, but there's such activity going on here in downtown Manhattan. As you may, something I forget periodically, and you may not have, New York was actually the first capital of the United States before Philadelphia, before Washington. It's there was a lot of action in downtown Manhattan, and Burr was there. He managed to get his law degree, practiced law in New York, sometimes alongside and sometimes in opposition to Alexander Hamilton. Both of them were making money and finding clients off the turmoil after the war. There were a lot of questions about who owned what. The loyalists who had fled, transactions that had happened under British law, were they going to be recognized by the United States? There was a lot of litigation in this period, and Burr and Hamilton were both in the middle of it. They sometimes opposed each other, but often were side by side in this. As political parties started to form, as they inevitably did, Burr tended towards the Democratic Republicans, who were generally thought of as the Southern Party. But he represented, in a way, the New York branch of that party. He had first said he would be above party, but as sides formed, ultimately, he couldn't always straddle the middle and began to identify with the Republicans, to use the shorter version of it. And Hamilton, of course, like John Adams, was a Federalist favoring strong central government. And the Westerners, like Clark and the Kentuckians, were very anti-Federalist. Quite likely to identify with the Republicans. So here in New York, Hamilton became a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He defended the new U.S. Constitution, and Burr took no real position on that. Through the publication of the Federalist Papers, Hamilton and Madison and Jay argued for the ways that the new country should be governed, how to interpret the Constitution. Burr did not get involved with that. We were inventing democracy. We were inventing how this thing would work with people voting, with legislators voting, with balancing small states against large states, with balancing Western states against Eastern states. And although the Constitution didn't envision these political parties, partisanship has been with us since about 15 minutes after the ink dried on the documents. Okay, let's look at Burr again. But besides having to invent a government, Americans were inventing a capitalist economy with shaky banking and an unsure grasp of how credit was supposed to work. Who could you count on? There was no real social ranking to know who was trustworthy. They had the remnants of a class system. The beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, different ways of manufacturing products coming from England. They had the beginnings of mass markets. They had the fall of mercantilism. They had to develop an economy. And they were quite unsure at this point of what the rules were. And it was easy to misunderstand and mischaracterize some of the different players in some of the schemes that emerged and what their motives were. Aaron Burr was always a high spender, a fine dresser. He was a man of sophisticated taste. He was constantly living in debt. He was often nearly bankrupt. He, like so many men of his generation, speculated in Western lands, even when Western just meant upstate New York. And he allied himself with promoters, explorers, embezzlers, adventurers, commercial interests. Some of these people were schemers. It was very hard to know what was a great project to invest in, who was trustworthy, what was legal, what was moral, who could say. Alexander Hamilton, when he became Secretary of the Treasury, produced a great report on manufacturers. It was an inventory of everything that was going on in the country, commercially, industrially, the different enterprises, and it was easy to see that with more roads and canals, America was moving. It was moving west, and that people who were able to seize the opportunity had great opportunities to make a fortune. So no wonder people were speculating in Western lands, Clark, the Grants. It was really the future. And so the interest in these things from on the part of Aaron Burr was completely understandable. You know, some of his speculations worked and some did not. Burr was elected to the United States Senate from New York and became interested then in foreign affairs. He had a special interest in France, which at this point was not unusual. France was having its own revolution. And the Americans had different opinions about whether to become involved. Was France maybe too democratic? Seeing the violence of the mob rule and later the ascent of a dictator like Napoleon, many were very suspicious of what was transpiring across the Atlantic, whether there were lessons for America, whether there was involvement for America, and especially what would happen with France's interests in North America. At this point of the mid-1790s, citizen Edmond Charles Genet arrived in America as an envoy from France. This is mid-revolution at this point, mid-French Revolution. He was particularly interested in the problem of Spain in North America, which was encroaching on the Spanish control of, the French control, rather, of the Mississippi, the ports of New Orleans. He found allies in America. There's no, let's see, do we have Genet? We do, who's Genet? There's no evidence that Burr himself was particularly close to Genet, but he was accused by the Federalist press, and at this point the press was highly partisan. They did not try to hide it. You were a Federalist newspaper, you were a Republican newspaper. He was accused of being too closely associated with the new French-inspired democratic societies. The Federalists just went to war against Burr and anybody who seemed too French in the papers. But we do know somebody who was involved with Genet. George Rogers Clark. Kentucky had been angry with the federal government for years for ignoring their grudge with Spain. Spain completely controlled all the Mississippi River commerce, which was nearly all of Kentucky trade. Kentucky could not survive without river access to the Gulf of Mexico and therefore to the east coast of the United States and Europe. Special licenses to trade through the port were held by very few men. One of them was James Wilkinson, and we'll talk about him more later. William Cron had a license to trade through the port, but that could be revoked at any moment. The whole situation was very shaky as long as Spain held on to the Mississippi Valley. Clark told Genet that with French backing, he would lead an expedition to remove the Spanish from the Mississippi Valley. He said, "I can take the whole of Louisiana for France." Genet made Clark Major General in the armies of France and Commander-in-Chief of the French Revolutionary Legion on the Mississippi River. So here is General Clark in the French army. Clark allies Benjamin Logan, Isaac Shelby, people he'd worked with for years, supported him. Clark spent his own money to buy supplies. We've heard that before. He had often done that before. He advertised for volunteers in the Kentucky Gazette. So while this was later called a treasonous conspiracy, it was certainly a very open conspiracy. Clark was not hiding this. So there's a question, was this legal? What's permitted? What's allowed? America was still inventing its foreign policy. In the musical Hamilton, there's a debate, it's cabinet battle number two, between Jefferson and Hamilton about whether they should intervene in France. But as in the song in the musical, where Washington, in an aside to Hamilton, says, "Hamilton, draft a statement of neutrality," Washington, George Washington, felt that neutrality was the way to finesse this quite difficult diplomatic situation. And Clark lost his approval, his investment, and was further discredited. Everyone associated with Genet was viewed with suspicion. Washington asked France to withdraw Genet, and he went back home. Clark, however, hoped that at some point this grand expedition could still be possible because it was still necessary, and he continued to write to his associates as if it was going to happen. The Treaty of 1795, the Pinckney Treaty, did open the port, but the issue of access was unsettled until after the War of 1812. So this was a long-standing problem. Burr, meanwhile, in pursuit of his political positions, was quite open about his campaigning. He practically invented campaigning. He invented the modern political party. Gentlemen didn't do things like that, but Burr realized that you needed to have an organized party. You needed to know who your voters were. You needed to know where they were. You needed to raise money. You needed to tell the voters what your positions were, that the kind of discreet, hands-off campaigning was not going to work in a democracy. So, while by the 1790s, Burr was closely associated with Western interests, he had the support of a lot of people who were involved in how to develop the West. The maps are very helpful. This is 1790, so this is a little earlier than the period I was just talking about, but you can see how with the Spanish controlling all of the southern and western part of what we now think of as the United States, the Mississippi River there going along the edge. This is before Kentucky is a state, but you can just see geographically that pinch point down there at New Orleans in order to get goods out. Okay, this is where I was going, sorry. This is Albert Gallatin, who became Secretary of the Treasury later, who is a Swiss-American, was very interested in what the process of developing the West would be, canals and rivers. Burr was associated with Albert Gallatin, and I love this because this is a photograph. To be able to have photographs of the people who were around in the 1790s is a great luxury. This was taken in the 1840s, but this is Gallatin. Senator John Brown of Kentucky, who had previously been involved in a conspiracy with Spain to separate Kentucky from the United States, also was conversing with Aaron Burr. Burr had been speculating in these Western lands. A crash in prices in the 1790s meant that Burr had to mortgage his house. His fine house in Greenwich Village was called Richmond Hill, and he had to sell his furniture and goods. So this was not a great time for him, the late 1790s, but fortunately his daughter, who was called Theodosia, the same name as Burr's wife, found a rich husband. She married Joseph Alston from South Carolina, and that helped Burr's fortunes in many ways, politically, financially. There are a number of portraits of her. She was highly educated woman, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but family connections continued to be just so important in who you could trust, who you would talk to. So, gotta get to the bad stuff. One of Burr's projects to enrich himself in this period was his water company scheme, and that did work out. It was the Manhattan Water Company. The idea was to supply Manhattan with fresh water. Or was it? The project spawned a bank for which Burr and the directors sold cheap shares. They invented a new kind of cheap stock that would be available to ordinary investors, the kinds of people who they wanted as voters. And you can't say that it's totally a bad thing. It irritated Hamilton and the Federalists quite a bit. And here's a bonus trivia question, which some of you may know. The Manhattan Water Company merged with other companies and still exists in modern corporate form. Does anybody know what Burr's water company became? It's J.P. Morgan Chase. The Manhattan Water Company, Chase Manhattan, J.P. Morgan Chase, all from that time period. There is also the Bank of New York, which Hamilton and Burr were both investors in, which is still around as Bank of New York Mellon. So these little ventures could be the tiny acorns from which great oaks would grow. You never knew whether you were about to lose your entire fortune on a canal scheme that doesn't pan out, or whether an investment in a bank is going to carry you through to a happy retirement. And it was a tricky time to know how to get ahead. Meanwhile, Burr was still working on building his party. He lost the famously contested election of 1800 for president to Thomas Jefferson. So Burr, at this point, is a national figure. He's a national leader. And what was the consolation prize if you lost the battle to be president at this point? You get to be vice president. Yes. And by now, Burr had serious enemies, including Alexander Hamilton. He was often portrayed in the press as dangerous and immoral and ambitious. He was not a gentleman, in a sense. He was also slandered as being a libertine, sexually adventurous, deviant, decadent, Epicurean, and some of that was really true. But then it was true of many men of his class and his generation. He was a man of the world in many ways. I think Gwen gave me that phrase. He was a man of the world, and he lived in a certain style. But his enemies roasted him for it. So when it became clear that Jefferson was going to dump him in the next election, he was not going to be vice president for the next term, Burr ran for governor of New York. He was still vice president at this point. He lost. He blamed Hamilton. There were complicated financial and family ties among many of the New York politicians. The Livingston family was very prominent. Does anybody think of a Livingston connected with Locust Grove? Serena's family, who married George Cron. The Livingstons were important. The Clintons were important. The Schuylers were important. The Schuylers were Hamilton's wife's family. The various factions and allegiances that formed were hard to break apart, hard to buck, and Burr just found himself on the wrong side of all of that. So you're going to hear about the duel in July. We have a speaker who's going to tell you all about the duel. So I'm going to just summarize, come back in July. But it's enough to say that in July of 1804, these long simmering rivalries between Burr and Hamilton, frenemies is a term we'd use now, became lethal. And after Hamilton's death, Burr fled from New York. He went to the rural South. He was indicted for murder and dueling in New Jersey and New York. He was still vice president at this point. And he hid out for a little while. But it turned out there were jurisdictional issues because the duel happened in New Jersey, where I believe dueling was legal, but murder was, of course, not. But Hamilton died in New York, where dueling was illegal, but was a murder in the course of a duel illegal. So the whole thing went into kind of legal limbo. So Burr went back to Washington, or went back to Washington, and presided over a famous impeachment trial. So here's this little side note. In the middle of crime and death and political disasters in Burr's life, because he's the vice president, he presides over the Senate. Remember, in the Constitution, the vice president presides over the Senate. He presides over the impeachment trial of a Supreme Court justice who Jefferson wanted to impeach because Samuel Chase, the justice, was so partisan in his decisions. Shocking that the Supreme Court could be partisan. But Chase was acquitted. It was decided that that did not constitute something that a Supreme Court justice could be impeached over. So pretty soon after that, Burr's term ended. Burr decided to go west in the great American tradition of what happens when everything dries up in the east, you go west. So let me just see where we are. Yes, okay. At this point, France had taken Louisiana, including the port of New Orleans, back from Spain, and Jefferson had bought it, as we all know, for the United States as the Louisiana Purchase. But Spain still had Florida and the Gulf Coast, see there, West Florida, East Florida there, and they still held the Texas-Mexico region and the coast west of New Orleans, And a little bit of territory, which is the entire interior of the western third of the continent, the Rockies, California. War with Spain for this territory was entirely likely, but the United States was not militarily very strong. They did not have naval gunships enough to secure the Gulf and especially the major rivers. Access to the west was from all of the rivers that we hear about, the Ohio, the Mississippi, the Missouri, but also the Cumberland. Many other rivers were the highways. The highways like the Natchez Trace were practically unusable at this time. And the rivers were so important, and the United States just did not have the naval firepower. And at this point, too, the Corps of Discovery, Lewis and Clark expedition, is heading across that territory. So that's the point when Burr sets off from Pittsburgh down the Ohio River. What did he have in mind? What was he doing? That is the essence of the Burr conspiracy, is figuring out the answer to that question. So I want to just introduce a new word to this discussion. It's filibustering. Now, this doesn't mean what you're thinking, probably. In this usage, it means a private army that acts against a foreign power with the consent of its own government. Or it could mean a rebellion to conquer land for settlement, usually in a time of war. It's basically a licensed army. It's from a Dutch word that means freebooting or piracy. And in post-revolutionary America, it really wasn't exactly illegal, but it wasn't necessarily legal either. Nobody knew. And it looks like that's what Burr was doing. He was filibustering. But how? His enterprise was surrounded by rumors, lies, scandals, false testimonies, self-serving proclamations, whispers, and secret-coded letters. So it is quite difficult, even at the remove of 200 years and a lot of research, to quite understand what was going on. Was he trying to raise an army against the Spanish possessions in order to settle? Was he trying to create a new country with himself at the head of it? Was he trying to detach the western states, like Kentucky and Tennessee, as part of a new territory? Was he starting a revolution? Was England involved in this? It's really hard to know. Everybody had an agenda, everybody had a version of what happened, and everybody lied. So, the cover story was that Burr was going to a meeting in Cincinnati with the directors of the Indiana Canal Company, in which he had invested. Let's see, no slide yet. In which he'd invested. Other directors of the Indiana Canal Company were George Rogers Clark and William Cron, and Burr allies Jonathan Dayton and John Brown. We've seen him before. And then the true villain in our history, James Wilkinson. The Indiana Canal Company was a quite legitimate venture. The idea was to build a canal around the falls of the Ohio, and we all know what a barrier to navigation the Falls of the Ohio is on the Indiana side. There was an Ohio Canal Company, which paradoxically wanted a canal on the Kentucky side. But the Indiana Canal Company was quite legitimate. But Wilkinson was a genuine traitor. He had been an important commander in the U.S. Army. He was governor of Louisiana. He helped to found Frankfort, Kentucky. And he was in the pay of Spain as a double agent, known as Agent 13. Yes. He was not a friend of George Rogers Clark, so he's no friend of ours. And according to President Theodore Roosevelt, Roosevelt said, "In all our history, there is no more despicable character." He used public service to enrich himself repeatedly. He slandered, he lied, he forged. He did whatever it took to benefit James Wilkinson. I don't know why anybody ever worked with him. Did they not see it? Apparently, many people didn't, or he was useful to them. While Burr was still back in Washington, he had definitely approached the British minister to the United States, a man named Anthony Mary. And this astonished Mary, because Burr, when he was still vice president, approached Britain with a plan for Britain to finance an expedition to separate the Western states from the Union and join them to Mexico, which would be freed from Spain. Mary asked London if this could happen, and the ministers in London never responded. There was silence. But this sounds a lot like treason, and this is testified with documents at the time that were part of British diplomatic record. So Burr seems to be up to something more than just going to find out how things are going with the canal company. So in 1805, Burr caught a barge from Pittsburgh down the Ohio. He was probably on a kind of reconnaissance mission. He wanted to find supporters, test local sentiment, get supplies and funds. He stopped at Blennerhassett Island in the mid-river, mid-Ohio River, off of Parkersburg, and met with Herman Blennerhassett, who invited him in, offered him comfort and support. It's not clear that Blennerhassett quite knew what Burr was up to, and if he had, if he would have invited him in. But it was rumors from this visit to Blennerhassett Island that would later take down Burr, because people who were there testified about what they'd heard or what they thought they had heard. It was, it's hard to have a conspiracy to mount an expedition that requires men and material without at least talking to somebody. So it's, as I said before, people who later testified lied, and it's hard to know whose version of things is exactly correct. But it, if there was a conspiracy, a lot of it started at Blennerhassett Island. Burr went on to meet with the Canal Company in Cincinnati, and in Kentucky he visited Frankfort and Lexington and Louisville and Locust Grove. Now, we know this only through a single reference in the Lyman Draper papers stating that Aaron Burr, as both Mr. Bullitt and Mrs. remember, did visit Louisville, and Mr. B. says it was said he dined at Major Cron's. Now, that sounds, if you were looking at this just objectively and knowing only this, that seems, you know, like pretty third-hand bit of evidence for him being here. But I think it makes sense. Was he there to see Cron? Was he there to see Clark? Either one could be an ally if carefully tested and probed. Cron was related to him. And during the Genet affair, Clark had proved that he was open to the idea of filibustering, and he was locally respected. Isn't it likely that Burr might have found in Clark someone with whom he could confidentially discuss something potentially treasonous? Maybe not. Especially someone who knew the territory, someone who knew how to wage a successful filibuster. Because you could argue that Clark's invasion of the Indiana Territory during the American Revolution under secret orders from Patrick Henry was in fact a filibustering expedition. So I like to think of Burr and Clark putting their heads together and figuring out what was possible. And whether this was treasonous, whether this would benefit the United States, is something that we can't really quite know from this remove. But Burr also quietly met with, Locust Grove, there's, if you look through the window there, you've got Burr and George Rogers Clark sipping whiskey and talking about the terrible, and it was a terrible problem, of Kentucky getting access to the Mississippi River. So Burr also quietly met with the owners of the four shipyards in the Ohio Valley that had been contracted by the federal government to build naval gunships. Remember that the United States did not have the naval firepower that it needed, and especially on the rivers. One of the men that Burr met with was Richard Anderson, who was, of course, related to the Crons. And Burr ordered some gunships from these shipyards using funds that were lent to him by the Indiana Canal Company. So we've got a scheme going on. This doesn't quite seem like the actions of an innocent man. He's building an armada. So after Louisville, Burr went on to Nashville. Oh, this is, I just put this in so you can see where the canal actually went. This is the Louisville side. At the bottom, you see the straight line of the canal going through Shippingport Island. One of the shipyards that Burr visited was on Shippingport Island, the Bertud and Tarascon. shipyard. So that's where the canal eventually went. But he went on to Nashville, and Andrew Jackson, who was a young man then, he went on to New Orleans and Wilkinson and returned overland to Washington. So it looked like Burr had done some reconnaissance. He'd found out about men, materials, sentiment in the region. He went back to Washington. There were rumors about this conspiracy. There was excitement about it in the West. There was fear about it in the West. But these rumors here on this side of the Appalachians, if they got to President Jefferson, he was not yet paying attention to it. He wasn't worried yet. The Federalist press, though, started to chime in and comment on what Burr was doing and what this conspiracy might be. So Burr, back in the East, comes up with another cover story. I think you can see where I'm going. I don't think Burr was entirely innocent in this affair. Another cover story. He purchased a huge tract of land in the Louisiana Territory near Texas. Let's see if we can get there. Called the Bastrop Tract. So if you see this map here, you can see where Louisiana and Texas are, the purple line of the Louisiana Purchase going through it. The Bastrop Tract is up there. This is a modern map of the state of Louisiana, but you can see it's quite near the border, so it's quite near Texas. This is 350,000 acres of land. Burr declares his plan to create a settlement there. You know, move along, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing to see here. I just want to settle Texas land, you know, Louisiana land. What's the problem? So it was starting to look like war with Spain wasn't going to happen, and war would have been a pretext for a filibustering expedition. So Burr may be going to plan B here. So heading west again, he's now really rounding up boats and supplies. Some people rallied to him, but not as many as he was probably expecting. By this time, there was a lot of suspicion. The newspaper stories, the rumors were spreading. Who was this Burr who had been vice president and now was going to make himself king of a territory, Trans-Appalachian territory? People were unsure about what he was doing, whether they would support it. Burr was arrested, and he was put on trial in Lexington. Henry Clay was his lawyer. And Clay stated that Burr's intention was strictly agricultural. He wanted to create a settlement. See, okay. You don't believe Henry Clay? Such skepticism. His settlement was a plan that would benefit the United States because, of course, we wanted settlers to be in this new Louisiana territory. What was wrong with that? And Burr was let go. It became clear that even if he did have this plan to separate Western states and invade Mexico, which was the worst construction that people could put on his affairs, it was not illegal. It was not technically illegal. So, meanwhile, Wilkinson. Traitors gonna be traitors. So, Wilkinson started to speak out against Burr. Wilkinson started to be worried about his own skin. He started to be worried about, here's New Orleans, lovely city, a little earlier. Wilkinson started to be worried about what Thomas Jefferson might do that would threaten him, James Wilkinson. And Jefferson finally became concerned and took action after numerous reports. Jefferson himself wasn't sure what to trust. What was true, what was false, but it seemed to make sense to stop Burr from whatever he was doing and get the story. Just as an aside, there are some people who theorize that Jefferson had actually approved of Burr's plan, that Burr, in 1805, back in Washington, D.C., had confided in Jefferson what he wanted to do, and Jefferson had said, check it out, explore it, see what happens. If we go to war with Spain, you're well-positioned to create facts on the ground. There's no evidence of that, but it is a possibility. Like I said, filibustering was a tactic used inside war in order to conquer territory. It may have been that Jefferson was fine with that. We don't know. So, but Jefferson at this point recalls Burr. At the point where Burr was captured, he had a group of about 100 followers. There were other people who were probably poised to join him, but hearing that federal troops were after Burr, they turned back. So we don't know what force of men Burr might have been able to assemble. But Burr said these were just settlers. They were going west. They were going to settle the Bastrop Tract. What's the problem? So he was brought to Richmond for trial. And I believe the reason why it was Richmond was because the testimony against him was treason at Blennerhassett Island, which was part of Virginia at that time. I believe it's now part of Ohio. But that's why he was in Richmond. It was the trial of the century, of the 19th century. It was 1807. The Chief Justice, John Marshall, presided over the trial. Burr hired excellent lawyers. He also defended himself. And just parenthetically, in the process of defending himself, Burr tested and proved the principle that a court can subpoena documents from a president, which is an issue that has been in the news lately. What will happen if documents are subpoenaed? In this trial, Burr was able to get Jefferson to turn over documents that Wilkinson had forged and sent to Jefferson. It's a little more complicated. There was a cipher letter that supposedly revealed Burr's plot. Wilkinson had taken it and transcribed it and had mistranscribed it so that Wilkinson appeared innocent and Burr appeared more guilty. That was the document that Jefferson had that Burr subpoenaed. The trial is extremely complicated, but this alone just showed the fraudulent, difficult to verify nature of all of these charges. And in any event, whatever it was that Burr had intended to do, it never happened. So he was let go again. But somehow everybody thought he was guilty of something. He was tainted by this. He killed Hamilton, gotten away with it. It seemed that he probably conspired to do something against the interests of the United States for his own gain, even if that wasn't technically illegal. And he was really, even though he had now escaped prosecution for murder and treason, and he was really still not out of the woods. He was deep in debt. He was one step out of debtor's prison. He was still under indictment for murder in New York, and nobody knew if that would ever come to fruition. So he did what people do when the East isn't working out and the West isn't working out. He went to Europe. He went to Europe under an assumed name. Initially, he was traveling, he was learning, he was having splendid affairs, many women. He was living on borrowed money. So in a lot of ways, it was a come down for somebody who had been Vice President of the United States, United States Senator. When the hostilities of the War of 1812 started, he came back across the Atlantic and he practiced law. He evaded prosecution for murder. And he married a rich widow, as one does. When Europe hasn't panned out, you come back and you marry a rich widow. Alazé Jumel, who was younger than Burr, was one of the richest women in the United States, if not the richest woman in the United States. The marriage only lasted, I think, 6 months, and the divorce came through the day that Burr died. He had never given up his interest, though, in somehow conquering or revolutionizing Spanish America throughout the rest of his life. After he went to Europe and came back to New York, he met and talked with various revolutionaries. He kept up with the affairs in South America, in Mexico. But he died in 1836, and he left very few explanations behind. This is the house that the Morris Jumel Mansion that still stands in Manhattan that Burr lived in with his wife at the end of his life. But I noticed when I was looking on a map just today, I said, oh, where is that? I should be able to tell people where that is. That it's in Upper New York, and it was right between the neighborhood of Washington Heights and the neighborhood of Hamilton Heights. So here is Burr at the end of his life, again, between the respect and fame that attaches to George Washington and to Alexander Hamilton, and he is caught in the middle. So the question remains, was Aaron Burr a villain? Is he the villain in your history? Again, to quote Hamilton, history obliterates. Was he an ambitious man with bad luck? Poor choice of friends, perhaps. James Wilkinson. Do not hang out with James Wilkinson. Did he make mistakes, or were they crimes? Was he a brave adventurer acting to solidify the claim of the United States to the Western lands? By the early 1800s, it did seem inevitable, as it does to us, that most of America would go from sea to sea and that New Spain would fall. Western lands were rich and tempting. Settlers and speculators could not be kept away. Lewis and Clark returned with great information about the paths to travel, what was out there, splendid opportunities. Someone was going to settle this land, and Juan of Burr and his associates. So let's see if we can go. Let's go back to, let's look at Aaron Burr again. Let's go all the way back. There. Maybe from this distance, we can redeem Burr a bit. We can take the distance of history and look at who he was as a man in his time, a time when you didn't always know what came next, when you didn't always know who you could trust, when you didn't know the directions the country would take. I said earlier we'd come back to Theodosia Barto Prievo Burr. You could do a musical about her alone. She's mentioned in Hamilton, but she's not a character. She and Burr had a surprisingly equal, an almost modern marriage. He was a feminist. She was a feminist. He was raised as a feminist. Burr adored and quoted the work of Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote Vindication of the Rights of Women. He believed in the rights of women to an education, to participate in public life, to have opinions of their own. The Burrs raised their only daughter, Theodosia, same name, to be witty and worldly and educated, just like any male of her station. She could not fully achieve that, and she tragically died at sea shortly before Burr himself died. But she is a remarkable woman as well. So this is an unusual thing about this man who was a feminist before there was feminism. He also supported the arts. He was a patron of the arts, supporting painters. John Vanderlyn was one of them. He paid for the education of a number of young people, some of whom may have been his illegitimate children. We're not quite sure. But he nonetheless paid for their education. He, as a lawyer, he defended women clients and helped to invent the practice of family law. At a time when often women had trouble finding a lawyer who'd represent them against their husbands. It was legally tricky. He helped to find the legal principles that would make that happen. He was a fair and impartial judge in the potentially quite explosive Chase impeachment trial in the Senate. This is just after the duel and before he goes west. It's what a time to help set precedents for the separation of powers and the roles of the branches of government. He was also a devoted father to the Prevost children, and he acknowledged and supported several children who were born out of wedlock to him. And maybe that doesn't seem all that admirable to us now, but in the context of the time, it was really the better choice. So the story of Aaron Burr has often been told by his enemies, so it's really hard to see the man through the fog of time. He didn't have great political theories. It made him somewhat of an outsider among the founders of America. He didn't write a lot, and what he did write got lost probably at sea with his daughter Theodosia. But he fought in the war. He helped lead the government. He did a lot to establish the political party system in America, and of course we're grateful for that. Political party system. So that's Aaron Burr, and it's really up to each person to look through the fog and the prisms and the mirrors and say, hero, villain, somewhere in the middle, a man of his time. That's it. So thank you. And I think we have a surprise. Is that true? Oh, I'm supposed to do this? Okay. So what's the plan for serving this?
We're going to serve the cake now. People can get cake at their leisure.
And then come back and sit down, because there's more. Okay, wait, before, start thinking of your questions and answers, but I have a commercial announcement now, or a plug. Let's call it a public service announcement. Many of you have heard, you read our Gazette, you may have seen in the news, we're in the middle of a capital campaign for Locust Grove. The goal of this campaign is to create the kinds of facilities on this site that will serve audiences of the next century. And when this site was established, the idea was that the main focus would be a tour of a historic house. You don't need other facilities, restrooms maybe. And while the tour of this historic house is still key to what we do so much more now, and we don't have the facilities that we need to do it. So our plans include an open-air pavilion, will be right out here, which will be a lovely addition to the site that we can use for our own programs. Big lectures, maybe it's bigger than this room, and for rental events, it will connect to this auditorium. There'll be a new kitchen. The wonderful lecture bakers who help do this spread every day will be pleased to have the space to actually do it in. So that's great. We're going to redo our lobby so that instead of having the cores in the middle of it that make it a sort of figure eight shape, those will hide our heating and cooling units. That will go up to the roof, and we'll have an open expanse, which will then have an enclosed museum store, glass enclosed museum store, and a space for temporary exhibits. We'll create a little bit more office space. We will have a real volunteer lounge. Those of you who are volunteers will have much more comfortable accommodations and lockers and everything. It'll be great. And a library. So all of that, better access to the site through an improved driveway. If anybody has slid down the icy driveway, yes, we're going to regrade that, re-landscape the parking lot so it's more attractive, and create an entrance to the new pavilion back here. New pathways that will help make the site accessible to people with mobility limitations or any of us who are inclined to trip as we read our brochure as we walk. And also lead to the outbuildings, which will be newly interpreted. So all of this, we are raising $3.2 million. I'm going to embarrass the leaders of our campaign by just pointing them out. Gwen Potts is the honorary chairperson of the campaign, and many of you know Gwen. Gwen and her husband, Grover. And then Kate Boyer, who is vice president of the board, is the campaign chair. So let's give them a round of applause. So our goal of $3.2 million was really made a possibility by an amazing gift from Preston Thomas, the late Dr. Preston Thomas, who many of you know, who gave $1 million to this effort. And so we've now raised $2.4 million. We have another $800,000 to go. That is the hardest part because we've already spoken to a lot of our most generous donors. The campaign is going wide. We will be doing mailings, which you will receive. And I hope that when you get this material in the mail, you are generous and write us a check, write down your credit card number, call us up, drop by, transfer stock, sell your children, whatever. So we will be asking you. So if you're interested, and we'll have a series of meetings too to let you know more about it, but I brought a copy of the plans with me, which I can pull out for anybody who wants to see. I've got some pledge forms too if you're ready to commit your children or whatever it is. And so I just wanted to let you know that this is it's coming. So thank you for that. Okay, questions. Aaron, back to Aaron Burr. Okay. Yes, one second, but yes.
The question I have, and this isn't your word, but the Falls of the Ohio looked so deep on this side. Were they actually that deep?
It depended on the time of year. The falls is really a series of rapids, and there were several chutes that you could go through. So it needed a skilled navigator, and there were some areas that you could only go through at high water, and when it was low water, there were times when it was completely inaccessible. So a canal was definitely the way to go, to dredge and create a canal, and it just turned out that given the formation of the geology that underlies it, the Louisville side was a better choice. than the Indiana side. Yes.
I still don't understand how he was able to avoid persecution. I mean, he murdered the guy.
Yes.
And he was known to have done that. How could he have come back?
The question is, why wasn't Burr prosecuted for killing Alexander Hamilton? And like I said, it had something to do with jurisdiction. I believe in New Jersey, dueling was legal, but murder was not. So I believe the question was initially whether Hamilton was complicit in his own death, but then it was determined by New Jersey, they just wanted to wash their hands of it, that because Hamilton had died in New York, New York would have to prosecute. So then in New York, dueling was illegal, as was murder, but there was again the question, Hamilton had voluntarily entered into this situation, so could you prosecute? And Burr did have powerful political allies, and I think they just basically stalled and buried it until finally it was quashed. The word, legal word quashed, meaning I guess they were not going to pursue it.
So was he just did it voluntarily?
Yeah. Hamilton, and in Burr's defense, I'm going to defend Burr now. Hamilton was part of something like 11 duels. Hamilton was very inclined to pick up the pistols when things got heated. Hamilton was constantly trying to follow the old code of the gentleman that said that any attack on your honor had to be vigorously disputed. And so Hamilton was quite inclined to duel. Burr had been involved in one duel before this, I believe was his second duel. I'm looking at Heather Heiner here, who I know is pretty up with it. Burr was a more modern man than Hamilton in a lot of ways. Burr saw that this kind of thing didn't work in a democracy, that the code of the gentleman that people had been living under was not the way of the future. That's why he looked at political parties as something that you really had to organize, and you had to go out and woo the voters, and you had to campaign, and you had to explain what it was, because people weren't going to vote for you just because your uncle's brother-in-law's third cousin was, you know, told you to do it. It was going to be a different system. So dueling was really the old way, and that was Hamilton. Yes. To Theodosia. She died. She did not live a long time. I think it was the 1790s. She died of probably uterine cancer. And they had had 4 children. 3 of them died. I believe 2 were stillborn. But Theodosia, who's named at Burr's request for his wife, lived. And Burr and his daughter, Theodosia, were very close. He wrote to her letters of such frankness, people are shocked that a father would write to his daughter that way, but they felt themselves to be very sophisticated, honest, open people who would be transparent with each other. Yes? Burr and Meriwether Lewis, no. I had not seen that. Anybody? No. Lewis, I believe, replaced Wilkinson as governor of New Orleans after Wilkinson got himself in trouble for being a traitor. But I don't think so. Somebody over here?
I was going to say that Hamilton's son was killed.
Yes. Yes, and if you've seen the musical Hamilton, who's seen Hamilton? How am I preaching to the choir here? Not a lot. The death of Philip, Hamilton's son, is an important scene in the play. And Philip has been raised by his father. The dueling is perfectly fine. Philip gets himself killed in Weehawken, New Jersey, in the same spot where Hamilton and Burr later dueled. So when Hamilton was shot, it was the same place where his son had died. Yes?
I was just going to say there's a really good biography of Burr in our library.
Nancy Eisenberg is the one that most people quote, although she is so pro-Burr. She bases it on research, but she is not as skeptical about Burr as I am inclined to be. And I think that the research about him soliciting naval gunboats came out after the time that she wrote her book, I believe. So she may not have had access to that information, which to me is pretty damning. He's not just establishing a settlement. He's either going to arm that settlement or he's really prepared to go to war to defend it. There's something going on with those gunboats. So I don't think she knew that. I don't know if it would have changed her mind. She's very pro-Burr. But if you read the Chernow biography of Hamilton, of course, he's very pro-Hamilton. So again, it's a lot of this is a lens that you look through what you think about people's actions. Yes, Gwen.
I would only want to underline the comment that you made in that the gunboats bring Anderson into it.
Right.
We know that Burr told Glossary that Clark was one of the most brilliant people he ever met as a consequence of meeting him here. And he was here having dinner. Every character we're most concerned about at this museum, Anderson, Cron, and Clark, was involved in Burr's plan,
right,
whatever it was.
Right.
And
yes, and I don't know that this period of time of Burr in Kentucky has really been examined all that thoroughly. I think there's room for a dissertation there if somebody wants to try to analyze the connections between all the people that he was meeting with in Lexington, in Frankfort, in Eddyville, and in Louisville. Yes. Right, right. People did change their minds. You know, even though the United States did not go from coast to coast, it was still a big country without excellent communications. Part of the problem with the Burr conspiracy is things would be happening in one part of the country that people in the other part of the country didn't know about, and vice versa. So there's a kind of disconnect in time between some of the events. You know, everybody in the West knew that Burr was up to something before anybody in the East was really ready to be concerned about it. So much of the information came from rumors, and it wasn't really until people were able to read each other's testimony or hear face-to-face that they realized that they had gotten different stories from the same person. The information about Wilkinson being an agent of the Spanish, Agent 13, didn't come out until, I think, the 1850s. There was a book written about it, which kind of flipped what a lot of people thought Wilkinson was up to at the time. So it's complicated. So there's no more questions. Let's just end with, it's complicated. And we'll all learn more. Okay. Thank you.